Hi, this is Derek Bruff here with a surprise bonus episode of Leading Lines. We are in between seasons right now. We're doing some interviews over the summer to get ready for our third season this fall. But we thought it might be fun to get the team together and turn the tables a little bit and interview each other. So what follows is a really fun conversation we had recently with the entire Leading Lines team. It was facilitated by the newest member of our team, Melissa Mallon from the Vanderbilt University Library, who'll be joining us for season three and taking on some interviewing. She was kind enough to jump in and try to facilitate a conversation with the fairly rowdy group that we have here at the Leading Lines podcast. So you'll hear from the whole team. There's me and also Stacey Johnson from the Center for Teaching. You'll also hear Rhett McDaniel from the Center for Teaching, whose voice you don't typically hear on the podcast because he's our editor and producer. We also had John Sloop, who's the Associate Provost of Digital Learning here at Vanderbilt. A couple of folks from the Vanderbilt Institute for Digital Learning, which we call VIDL, V-I-D-L. That would be Gayatri Nara Simham and Oli Mulvig. And then also Cliff Anderson, also from the library. We sat down and had a really fun conversation about a lot of things. We talk about the origin of the podcast and kind of what we've learned by doing the podcast. We explore the notion of educational technology and what that really means. Talk about some of the kind of spin-off things that have happened because of this podcast, and have a lot of fun with the question about analog educational technologies. So I hope you enjoy this bonus episode. As I said, Melissa Mallon's kind of getting us started, so hers is the first voice that you'll hear.
Okay, so you have all been doing this podcast for about 1 year now. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about reflecting back to the early beginning stages, the brainstorming stages for creating the Leading Lines podcast. Talk a little bit about some of your hopes and goals maybe for the podcast.
Well, so this is Derek Bruff from the Center for Teaching. And I had an idea a few years ago, actually, to do a podcast on educational technology, where we interviewed some people from Vanderbilt doing cool things, but then interviewed some folks outside of Vanderbilt also doing cool things, just because I think in my work I run into faculty especially doing really interesting and innovative things with technology all the time, and I like kind of sharing their stories. And so I had that idea in my head for a little bit, and then John Sloop mentioned something similar at a meeting we were having. John?
Well, I'll say I brought this up as an idea because I, you know, like a lot of us, have been listening to a lot of podcasts and thought we had an opportunity to do outreach from Vanderbilt. And I hadn't thought originally about interviewing Vanderbilt faculty, what was going on here. I was thinking about outside. And as soon as I mentioned it, of course, Derek said, "Wait a minute, this is my idea. I've had this for a couple of years." And so we had to figure out how to do this. And the thing is, Derek has a pretty large social media presence for his, you know, especially in his area. So he was really the right person to pull this together. And it took a lot of brainstorming on all of our parts to figure out how to do this. I think it came together organically. We started talking about our interest, and we started finding out we had sort of areas. They overlap, but different areas that we were interested in. So I was interested in structural issues, for example, and it came around that way.
How did you decide who to bring into the podcast group?
Well, that was almost coincidental in that we had already been doing, I mean, this came out of our EdTech Roadshow meetings, basically. So a few units, the Center for Teaching, the Institute for Digital Learning, and the library had been asked to put together a roadshow to take to faculty meetings to talk about our technology offerings and services for faculty. And so we had a number of good meetings kind of figuring out what we were going to say in that roadshow and kind of figuring out what VIDL did versus CFT versus library. And then as we were, I think we were kind of debriefing some of those meetings when we came up with the idea. And so so that was kind of the core, was we were going to have some VIDL folks and some CFT folks and some library folks. I think one of the things, I mean, you asked about kind of our hopes, right? Like, it's the metaphor of the title, the Leading Lines. We're trying to kind of say something about where educational technology is going, and that's my interest, is trying to kind of figure out what's happening now and where it might be moving. A lot of the negotiation early on was about kind of how big of a tent are we going to have when it comes to educational technology. And I think we've landed at a pretty big tent, and we've got a lot of different perspectives on the team. And so when you look at the types of folks we've interviewed and the topics we've covered, it's all educational technology, but it's sometimes very different kind of parts of educational technology.
Can I jump in a little bit on this, Ole Moldig on Vital and the History Department, on this concept of the Big Tent? And I think it kind of was created at the size it was, in part because if you want to include all of us around this table, it's going to need to be somewhat large, because your definition of what is the core of ed tech, not necessarily what counts as ed tech, but what's the core of it, what's the kind of the central part that we might want to be looking forward, is really quite different than what my own is, or what Gathers might be, and so forth, or those at the library. So I think it's a, by definition, with this group, we need to have a sense of ed tech large enough to kind of include all of our interests. So as you look at those podcasts, there's really quite a range of what is the topic of interest and what we think is exciting about here on campus and elsewhere.
So you all had your own maybe varying ideas of what ed tech was before you started coming into this process. And based on the episodes that we've seen so far, there's been a pretty good range of the people that you've interviewed. So I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about your experience with the people you interviewed, and if that anyone's changed your minds. That could be from your own podcasts that you've recorded, or maybe from ones that you've just listened to from your colleagues here.
I'm Gayathri from Vital. So I have listened to a few podcasts, so my experience with podcasting was very new, and educational technology was also after I started my work at Vanderbilt Institute for Digital Learning. And so my background is in cognitive development and cognitive psychology, so that was a perspective I had. And the people I interviewed, the first person I interviewed was an entrepreneur in the UK who was doing something with online learning, which was very similar to what we did at Vital with the MOOCs, the Massive Open Online Courses. But he was also a cognitive science researcher, and so he came from that perspective. But then the second person I interviewed was from was doing a lot of work with Wikipedia, and so that was a completely different kind of expertise and a different kind of technology. So it gave me a breadth of, you know, what it is. So even while it was much later in the game, it's still, with all the other interviews coming in between, this was really very interesting to see that kind of like the breadth of perspective from all the people that are being interviewed, as well as the interviewees who are asking these questions, the interviewers and the interviewees. And then the third person I interviewed comes from the Holocaust Museum. And again, his perspective is very different. He's using technology to actually bring something unconventional that was not going to fit the technology to actually make the students and the college, high school students and college students to get that perspective, as well as use the technology to make that those ideas popular. So I thought it was very fascinating to see this range of different kinds of things.
One of the ways that I think working on the podcast has broadened my view of educational technology is, and it connects a little bit to that last example, Gayathri, is the challenges around helping students either create something digitally, or share something digitally, or enter a digital space, or critique things, you know, digital texts and digital creations. I tend to think of educational technology as what are the tools that any instructor in any classroom situation could use and get some mileage out of. And so I tend to take a kind of content agnostic approach to educational technology. So, it's not high tech, but like a think, pair, share, you can use in any classroom situation anywhere, doesn't matter what you're teaching. But I think through, like, the interview with the Jan Homovic from Clemson, with the other kind of digital studies folks that we've talked to, even some of the digital humanities conversations we've had, there's some really hard questions about how technology is changing our disciplines and what we study and how we study and what we produce and create. And I think it's really interesting to think about how we bring our students into those conversations. So that's the piece that I think was kind of the newest or the most different for me.
I think that's helpful, Derek. This is Cliff Anderson speaking from the library. My portfolio includes, my title is Associate University Librarian for Research and Learning. So I'm trying to think about how those things fit together. And Melissa and I work together, and I think we're trying to figure that out, too.
It's a constant struggle.
But, you know, I think my tendency is to focus on technologies really useful for research and then think about how to teach them, which is a different type of strategy. So, you know, we do a lot of digital scholarship education. We run workshops. We run regular weekly working groups. And so, you know, we're thinking constantly about how to introduce people to these new technologies and to help them think about the affordances, what they make possible in their domains that wasn't possible before, or more efficient, or whatever. But, you know, I think it's really helpful to think about your perspective, which is, you know, what can apply across classrooms broadly. And I think that things meet in the middle somewhere. Some of the tools that we teach, I think you could use in any classroom setting. For example, GitHub or source control. There's always a reason you have to save something, and you want to see how other people who have taken your document have made changes to it and see that over time. That's a kind of generic idea, right? But, you know, in some of the interviews I did, for example, with Catherine Tomaszek, you know, that's about teaching digital text encoding, which, again, is really, really useful for historians focusing on making sure they understand the text at a deeper level than just the casual reading. And I think that is applicable across the humanities, but I wouldn't think that it's necessarily applicable in some of the sciences or social science, or at least not in the same way. So, I think that's a helpful distinction to make, and I may be sitting on one side of that from you, just like we're sitting on opposite sides of the table.
Yeah. But it's helping me think. I mean, what I can do in my position is to try to do some abstraction from that, right? Yeah. So if I can learn something about how Kati Borner teaches data visualization, well, I may be working with faculty who aren't teaching data visualization, but is there something about how she teaches or how she grapples with those technologies, how she works with students, that those processes could transfer quite nicely to other contexts?
Yeah, definitely.
I want to talk about this just a little differently. It's not just about the content of these podcasts, and we're hearing a lot of that around the table right now, but we're actually, the process of producing this podcast, of making it, has been a deep dive for each one of us into an educational technology, watching the, you know, getting our hands dirty, seeing how an argument is built. And I mean this from some very fundamental small things that would seem obvious at first. I mean, planning out the interview, finding the place to speak, having Rhett, our producer, irritated when I let wind blow into the... So all of those elements, right, of putting it together have encouraged me to think in ways that I want our students to think, to really think about all of the elements of building an argument, which are not simply looking, researching, and finding, but then how does sound become part of an argument? And so we branched off, so Gayatri and I are interested now in doing some production, et cetera. And I think that deep dive that we have done here is going to be helpful for all of us in thinking about other types of technologies.
Because you launched another podcast in the last year, I think in part because of your experience working on this one.
Well, that's absolutely true. I was a podcast consumer exclusively before I happened to be in the room at the right meeting and became included in this podcast. I'm Stacey Johnson with the CFT, by the way. And so because of the kind of person I am, when I get into something new, I don't dabble. I head first into it. So I started listening to a lot of podcasts about podcasts as part of like thinking about how I was going to produce an episode, even though I didn't have to technically produce it because we do have an amazing producer. I just had to find the interview subject and sit down with them and record it and then sort of hand it off. But I wanted to be more involved. And another thing that you guys might not know about Rhett is he is an amazing teacher of technology. So for our faculty who schedule consults with him to learn Adobe software or to learn how to create great effective PowerPoint slides or how to create podcasts, I spent weeks slogging through online tutorials with Audacity and listening to all these podcasts about podcasting and really cracking my coconut trying to figure out how to make this happen. I sat down for 1 hour with Rhett and learned everything I still to this day don't know any more than I did after that hour about audio editing and putting things together. And both of the interviews that I recorded for this podcast, one in season one and one in season two, were both sort of challenging audio. One, because in order to craft a good story, I had to move the audio around into different places than it had naturally occurred in the conversation. And one, because it was three people in a crowded lobby at a conference. And so there were just a lot of audio challenges. And every time, instead of just taking it and doing it for me, Rhett took the time to sit down and teach me how to do it and let me do it myself. And man, it was, I had a lot of fun. I had so much fun that I decided to recruit my graduate students in the course I teach in the fall and spring here to produce interviews that I now have turned into a podcast called We Teach Languages. So it's been really transformative for me. I've learned completely new skill set and went out on my own and have started my own thing. So thanks.
You're welcome. This is great.
Hi, this is Gayatri again. I want to reflect back on both what John said and what Stacy said because, and like I mentioned, that was my first podcast. But at the very beginning, when we were discussing how this podcast was going to come together, we talked about some skills going online, looking up how other podcasts are crafted and some best practices and tips like that. It completely flew out of my head when you're actually doing the interviews, right? So, and the most tricky part is you have a set of questions, and you said this, Melissa, when you started. You have a set of questions, and you go on tangents when you think that something is more interesting. That, I thought, was really the best learning experience for me. When I'm genuinely interested, I feel like my audience will be interested as well. So I think that's a great aspect of this learning, this whole putting together the interview, not just from our, you know, okay, we've done some research in the background, we've got some questions in mind, but going forward and after they say something to explore boldly in those ways. That's what I thought was really cool.
Well, I like that you say that because I've already changed my questions 3 times since we started this podcast. So
that makes me think one of the things that I think we set out to do and we've done in various different ways is to not just cheerlead. We invite interesting people on the podcast who've done interesting things, and we want to kind of celebrate that and affirm that and let them tell their stories. But I think we've also wanted to push back a little bit sometimes or question or just express some skepticism here and there. I know for me, some of the hardest interviews I've had is when things seem to be going off topic and I had to figure out how to bring them back on and probe a little bit more to kind of see, okay, what's the teaching angle here? And so that's a skill that I think I'm still developing is when to push back, when to criticize, when to probe, and when to just say, you know, that's fantastic, tell me more.
I'm glad you brought up skepticism. It's kind of the reason I got into this podcast in some ways, is through the use of EdTech, particularly in the humanities, I have found to be somewhat trivial might not be the best word, but the first way you get into it tends to not want to take up too much time in the classroom for the standard types of teaching that I'm used to doing. So you might pick an assignment that you think the students can learn the technology really quickly. But is that really kind of the best way to spend the time of learning? And I'm trying to, in my series, talk to people who have decided to substantively teach their students a new trick, a new skill that is going to take time away from the classroom before it was designed to include this kind of component. So, for example, Lynn Ramey teaching Unity and other kind of game engine technologies, they're not trivial. And so you need to decide this is worth teaching, and that the skill you learn might not be a humanistic skill, but the idea being learning this technology is really key to some other form of kind of technical development or digital literacy or competency. And so that for me has really been, as we talk about how the podcast comes about, the same process that I'm hoping the students are encouraging when you give them a much more challenging technology to work with, as opposed to let's take your argument and move it from a written paper to one that has pictures in it or one that has, it's done on a web page or whatever the case might be, to really kind of invest in that process more than just it's a new kind of assignment because it'll generate more interest.
So has anyone incorporated anything you've learned from your interviews or from some of the different technologies or techniques that have been discussed into your teaching or your work with students?
Absolutely. So I taught a first-year seminar in the spring, and what I decided to do, and this sounds not exactly what Stacy did, but she's already referred to doing something from her class, but I had the students, as a result of doing this podcast, I had my students, actually Rhett came into class and taught them how to use Audacity and some fundamentals, and had them work on presenting their ideas and arguments in a different form. And I had to be very careful because it's too easy to see this just as a way of recording. So I had to be very careful to make sure they didn't simply record a reading of their paper, but to think about the full set of tools and skills around how to build a different type of argument, how to get people to think differently with sound, right? So arguing with sound was sort of the way I talked about it. And so I brought that into the class. I'm stunned, actually, at how successful it was. I have some work to do on thinking hard about how to assess that work, and I'm going to have to rely on some conversations with Derek, Stacy, and others to learn how to do that. But yeah, I think the things that we're learning both in content and in doing this are helping me go in directions where I might have sort of thought, good idea, but I wouldn't have gotten around to it, right? And so actually getting to some of what Ollie's talking about as well. It's easy to be both highly optimistic and highly skeptical of some of this. I mean, getting down and doing it has taken me in some direction. Stacy, do you want to follow up on what you talked about with your podcast with your students?
Well, I have often had my students, there's a small portion of the overall grade, which is community participation. And this is a course for future language teachers. Mm-hmm. And so one of the ways that they can participate in the community is to interview a language teacher and report back. So for the fall and spring course, they recorded that interview and created, you know, I had like some questions and some guidelines. And then I've taken those interviews that they recorded and sort of plugged them into the podcast format. Mm-hmm. It's some of the really cool benefits that I didn't anticipate was I have some graduate students who are going to go either to American institutions or to go abroad, and they're going to be applying for jobs as teachers. And now they have a podcast with their voice and their name and their branding where they're talking about language teaching really intelligently, interviewing experienced teachers. So it's in addition to the benefits that it already had in the class of like creating this artifact, they also have something that is part of their professional portfolio after they leave their training in education. So that's been really cool. I have already been brainstorming ways to expand that for the classes I teach in the coming year. And I'm actually offering the opportunity out to just the general public, like to listeners of the podcast or language teachers just in the world who might have a great language teacher that they would like to interview using the guidelines and the format. Why do they have to be a student at Vanderbilt in order to record one of these interviews? If they follow the same guidelines, I can make it into a podcast, no problem. And then we'll just be crowdsourcing like all this knowledge out into the world. So I'm having a lot of fun coming up with new ideas.
I saw your tweet on that. That was great.
Yeah. Wow. So we're only 10 episodes in, so it's a really new podcast, but my most recent guest was so excited about the possibility of being able to contribute to a podcast without having all the responsibility of being the podcaster that she already has a couple things lined up, and I'm really excited about the direction it's going to go. So,
and on that note, I will say I think one of the things that's worked really great with our production process is that since we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and now 7 of us who will be doing interviews, we get a lot of interviews with a lot of people, and I think maybe this is different for you guys, but you can kind of plug in and focus on your interview without having to kind of worry about the whole process. I mean, we have, you know, a couple meetings a year where we talk about the whole process and put together the other pieces of it, but that ability to have a team-produced podcast, I mean, you're kind of expanding that notion even more, but I think it's allowed us to go in some really interesting directions. It's way more interesting than what I would have done if it was just me doing all the interviews.
Well, one thing that I think we've done right, and this is kind of comes back to the production of the podcast, this is Cliff Anderson again, is that we've produced transcripts of our episodes.
Oh, yeah.
And I think, you know, that's really been, for me, very helpful because unlike some of you, I guess the benefit, I live very close to the campus, so I don't have a commute, so I don't listen to podcasts in my car where I think a lot of people do. But being able to just scan through podcasts and read them, I think, is just a terrific thing. And we do crowdsource that, as you know, through a service called Casting Words, which puts it on Amazon Mechanical Turk. It's kind of an interesting technology in itself. But, you know, I think that just makes it accessible to people that might not, for whatever reasons, be able to listen to our podcast. So I'm happy that we've made that choice, and I hope other podcasters around campus will do the same.
I want to say one more thing. This is John Slib again. And this is not about, this is more about the content of the podcast than us doing this. One of the things that you can't help but walk away from, and this is with all of the interviews, is we're interviewing people who are immersed in educational technology and aren't thinking in terms of, here's one tool, how do I use this? But they're thinking about really a change in sort of epistemology, a change in ways of doing things. And that can't help but, and I think everyone here has that same sort of mindset anyway, because we're the people doing this. But that emphasis in the conversation can't help but change the way you approach problems on a daily basis. So I think this content really is coming back to change the way I think about issues that I face every day.
John, one of the interesting things about our group is that we're all coming from really different disciplinary perspectives. It might actually be fun to sweep around the room and say what our disciplines are. I can start.
Yeah.
I have a PhD in theology and a degree in librarianship.
Well, wait a minute. While you're doing that, tell us a little bit about, I mean, we'll make it brief, but tell us a little bit about how you think that shapes the way you...
That was meant to be a quick sweep, but okay, yeah, I'll say more about it.
Quick
sweep. I don't know. I mean, I think that's the answer. Like, I think theology as a discipline is really synoptic. It includes just so many perspectives. I mean, I actually wrote my dissertation in part on this question. Is theology a science? That's a pretty 19th century antiquated question. But the point is there any discipline that theology doesn't connect with? And I think you'd be hard to say, like, that's one of the challenges as a librarian. If you collect in the areas of theology, you're going to be collecting psychology, you're going to be collecting hermeneutics, you're going to be collecting philosophy, you're going to be collecting communication studies, you're going to be... So even mathematics. Mm-hmm. So you know, from my perspective, that makes me think about these issues, I think, from a pretty high-level perspective and think, how would someone thinking from that disciplinary perspective connect someone to someone who's thinking from this perspective, and can the technology, in a sense, as Derek said, provide a pathway for them to talk to each other? But that's more than a quick sweep.
That was more than a quick sweep. I still like the idea of going around, but everyone try to be succinct. Not the critique of you, Cliff.
Ole Molvig. Mine's pretty quick. History of science and technology, and I'm really keen on looking at technology and society at this current moment, not just historically. And this is one of these areas that is changing the landscape of education, society in general, and I'm really excited to look at it, both comparing the historical to the current present practices.
So I sort of straddle the fields of language teaching, language pedagogy, and adult learning. And I think a lot of what I do with educational technology falls more on the adult learning side. How do adults learn new skills and start to think of them as indispensable?
So I'm a mathematician by training. And I think for me, it's what I mentioned earlier about kind of abstraction. I think mathematicians are good at seeing patterns across, you know, instances of things. And so the structures that we're looking at aren't the mathematical structures that I would be used to studying, but looking for the commonalities and the kind of abstract layers of what's happening in teaching and learning contexts.
I already mentioned, this is Gayathri again, my background is in cognitive development and cognitive psychology, and I studied learning to learn, so metacognition. So pattern recognition is definitely a part of that. But more than that, it's about when it comes to adult cognition, it's more about how best do you learn. And we are not always very cognizant of that. So I think, you know, doing the podcast and actually learning by doing is one of the big things that I think. And having students do the podcast enables them to understand perspectives about themselves that they might not get otherwise. So that's perspective.
John Slope, and my background's communication studies, but more specifically, I do research in media ecology and rhetoric. And so I'd say media ecology is basic, I mean, real traditional from Marshall McLuhan, medium is the message up through sort of the new materialist, Bruno Latour. And I think that part's obvious. It gets into how do technologies shape how we think and who we are, right? And how do they work with us, for us, you know, as agents. The second thing, though, and I think the one that I've said a couple of times during this process is rhetoricians think very much in terms of intentional and unintentional argument. And so I'm always thinking in terms of how an argument of some sort is being built and transmitted and communicated differently through different technologies. And that becomes a real important way I think about these.
Well, I have something to connect to a previous question, if that's all right. Earlier, Melissa, I think you asked if we've picked up any new skills, and I don't think that's how I would describe the change, but I have undergone a change. So when we first sat down to talk about what our paths were going to be in the podcast, I thought that I wanted to talk to people who took a critical perspective, but I have since really come to understand my own perspective on educational technology better from listening to the episodes and thinking about who I wanted to interview. And it's not actually a critical perspective that I crave. It's more of that skepticism of widely applicable solutions. I mistrust solutions. I don't think they usually solve anything. And I think individual faculty can and should be empowered to choose tools, learn them on their own or with help. There's a lot of help available here on campus. And to apply those in a way that they feel excited about and that sort of represents their creative personality in their research or in their classroom. And so the people that I've interviewed so far are people who take a lot of ownership of technology and don't apply a solution that's been handed to them out of a box, but have really made something work in their context. And not only that, encourage other faculty to say, don't buy into the hype. Do what you think is best. And if that's sitting side by side with someone looking over paper, then that's the technology that works for you. But you have to make choices based on what you in your gut feel is right for a course. And I love that ethos. And it's something that I feel very strongly at Vanderbilt too. Faculty generally feel very empowered to do what works for them. And the ones who dive into educational technology wield it in really interesting ways and use it to do interesting things. So it's been fun for me to clarify that I'm actually not interested in a critical perspective. I'm interested in personal empowerment. And what does that mean when we're in sort of a corporate ed tech bubble? How do you really listen to the individual and make sense of specific contexts and use cases?
So to play off of that, we talked about a big tent approach to ed tech. And I think sometimes I see conversations on Twitter and elsewhere where ed tech is taken to be a one-size-fits-all corporate for-profit monstrosity, right? There's usually a lot of criticism of that. But I sometimes get frustrated when I see people kind of assume that ed tech means it's some, you know, $20 million contract with some vendor.
Right. It's a new startup.
Right. It is that. Or startup, right? Yeah. Startup culture. Like, yeah, it is that. But when I think of ed tech, I think of individual instructors making choices about what technologies to use that fit their teaching context and their students. And so I get a little grumpy sometimes when people assume that ed tech is some kind of monster when it's also this other stuff that's actually really personal and really impactful.
You know, I think that's a great distinction because I've had difficulty explaining, especially when I'm talking to unconventional people, what is education technology? And it's not just one technology, right? In my mind, it's like this whole slew of things that come under that banner of education technology. But maybe in their minds, it's not that. It's just that one piece of something, technology that they know.
Right. And it's the course management system that they have to use, right? Like, well, yeah, that's one way to think about educational technology, but there's a lot of other ways to think about it.
Right. And it's not just teaching, right? I mean, we ignore the research part, but I think that there is a lot of technology in research that spills into in teaching, too, that we just don't see the connections between those and not necessarily in our interviews as well, so...
Well, I think that's an exciting way to think about the coming year, too, is that exploring some of these, maybe skeptical, maybe not, you know, what else does EdTech mean beyond what you've explored so far this past year? And before we wrap up, I had one last question I wanted to ask, and this is sort of a callback to your previous podcast. You always end by asking, what's your favorite non-digital analog educational technology? So I thought it would be interesting to hear from you all if you could answer that question for the listeners. We'll start with Patrick.
I love books. I'll stop at that.
Yeah, but no, you can't. I want to know. I want to know something from that. To say I love books, what you clearly mean is you love, you're talking about analogic books, but we can have the same book on, and you're saying by saying I love books, you're making a preference for the materially bound book.
Right,
why?
The hard copy.
Why? You can't just throw that out there.
Okay, I'll explain if I can. I like the actual feel of the book, the way it's written. I think from an education perspective,
let me think. I mean, it's more and more I see that we are using electronic resources. But I come from an old school where electronic resources were not always available and we had to use books. And I think the books actually give you some... I've never thought about it deeply, so I'm going to delve into concepts. I'm going to go on tangents. Maybe it gives you a perspective into how the author has built through the arguments, through, you know, structuring the book in a way they've done in terms of, like, you know, having the content in the beginning and building it towards building the content over the pages. And it's not always obvious in many cases, but it's obvious in textbooks. It's obvious in books that have a compendium of research that has been exposed. So those are very valuable skills that you cannot easily develop when you look through an online text, because you can scroll through really fast. You will miss out on all those details.
Valid.
I'd like to punt a little bit on the question that my favorite part is when students experience an analog technology they hadn't thought of for the first time and realize its either utility or perhaps often greater utility. One of the most simple ones is the index card, where when you point out that an index card with an argument and one piece of evidence on it, and then show them a table, just how much screen space you can get if you think of that as essentially a digital paragraph spread out on a table and manipulable physically in terms of kind of creating an argument is one of the kind of aha moments that I see my students surprised at such a simple thing can have utility that they assume the computers always, the word processor is always going to be better. And this is a case where it really isn't.
Cliff.
Yeah, you know, this is interesting because I think a lot of the work that I had done, you know, for example, I'm taking a bus trip to Atlanta and I was thinking I'm going to bring a notepad and I'm going to write an article that I'm going to give at one of my talks. And I thought, I really don't want to do that. And, you know, so I'm not against the pencil and I'm not against writing and I'm certainly not against books as a librarian and I run our special collections here. And so everything Godfrey said, I should just put up like on a poster on the wall then, like, you know, like I love books.
Yeah, that took a lot of thought going out on a limb. You cannot steal my ideas.
I'll give you full credit for your ideas. We're going to print a poster of them. That's fantastic.
Librarians are good at attribution.
Yeah. But, you know, so I think from my perspective, in a way, this is a more challenging question to me. I mean, I continue to use note cards and pads and paper, but just a lot of my learning has migrated online. So it's harder for me. I think one thing I would say is I still use rulers when I read, and this is maybe a bad habit. Do you all do this? So I put a ruler on the page, and I underline really straight lines because I don't like to have wavy lines under my underline. So when I'm working on a physical book that I own, not a library book, and I'm marking it up, I will use a ruler to make a very exact line.
That's a good answer. I like that.
Okay, a weird answer.
I think an entire episode just with us saying our heartfelt favorites and John arguing with why they're not good.
I'm going to go ahead and answer this question, and mine has nothing to do with smelling books or using rollers. I'm going to steal my answer from someone else. I can't remember who gave this. It was either on one of the podcasts before or Derek. I can't remember who said this, but first off, in a way, it's a nonsensical. If you take a real strong media ecology position, it's a nonsensical question because all of our technologies are now digital technologies, are thought through that way, or have shaped that way, or become that, right? So I can no longer read a book without thinking about it through that, right? But I think the answer that I gave that I still hold on to is not a technology in the sense of a material technology, but group projects. And I can't remember who said that, but I thought, yeah, that's a technology of teaching that I think is very important, that bringing people together and having them work together collectively, which actually works really well with digital technologies, but also works well across a room. And the group project as a technology of teaching lends itself to different kinds of work and can work with all types of technology. So that's the answer I would give. Does anyone remember where someone said this before in one of these?
I think Enoch Hale.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think it's an interesting answer, right? Mm-hmm. Because I just gave one.
So this is not my answer, but I want to follow up on what Gayatri and Cliff said. I think there is an aesthetic quality to the technologies that we use. I mean, our digital technology has aesthetic qualities as well. And I think that's what I hear in both of your answers, actually. I'm reminded of the vote we had in the math department a few years ago. We were renovating classrooms, and we had to vote on whether we wanted to move from chalkboards to whiteboards for all the classrooms. And the math department voted, like, I don't know, 20-3 to stay with chalkboards. And I didn't talk to them all. I don't know why, but it took me a while to figure out why I prefer chalkboards to whiteboards. And it is the line quality of the chalk. It's the ability to do thick and thin lines with chalk that it's purely aesthetic, right? But it engages me in a way that makes me want to be there and be a part of the process. And so I think I hear that in your answer about books, that there's an immersive aesthetic piece to that that I think students can experience. And even how you encounter the book is through really straight lines, right? That says a lot about your personality, though. But it's aesthetic, right? And I think those qualities of the technologies we use actually do matter.
I don't know if you'll recall, but in the interview with Paul DeHay, he was also a mathematician.
Yes.
He chose chalk.
Yes.
He chose chalk, he says, as well.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Stacey, do you have anything?
I do, and I was going to say books, but now I'm afraid to say books. So I've thought through a little more to that. I do love books, and I was that kind of little girl who my mom would take me to the library every week, and I had a little cardboard box with handles on it, and I would take all of my books back and get a new cardboard box full of books, and just like now, they were usually nonfiction and usually on a similar topic. So I would say, I'm going to learn everything about bunnies this week, and I would just read every bunny book all at once, and even though I do own more books than any human should own, I still go through a lot of library books and audiobooks through the library app, which, Cliff, you told me about. Thank you so much. This has been amazing for me. I can listen to, like, a book a day now. So because most of my books have come from the library, I never wrote in any books, even ones I owned. It's honestly hard for me to keep track of which ones are mine and which ones aren't, but I just have never had the habit of writing in books. I use post-it notes in my books. So my well-loved books that have been read several times, every page will just have post-it notes all over the side hanging out, and they get sort of gnarled, and it'll say, like, an interesting quote or something I want to look up, and I just go through the book over and over, absorbing my post-it notes and the text, and there's no lines or anything, but there's just... Oh, those little skinny post-it notes are great for underlining, and the big post-it notes are great for finding quotes. So the combination of a big box full of library books and a fresh pack of post-it notes is a really exciting combination for me.
So, Derek, do you have your favorite
chair? Actual answer, yeah. It's in my Twitter bio, Wheels on Chairs. Right? When I walk into a classroom, I want the furniture in the room to support the learning activities that I have designed and intended for that day. And the more flexible the furniture, the easier it is to move around and reconfigure, the more the technology, right, the analog technology of furniture and classroom affordances can support the teaching objectives that I have. So that's always my answer, wheels on chairs.
That's great. Does anybody have anything else they want to share for the good of the order?
Thank you, Melissa,
joining
our team.
Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely.
Conversing with us today. This has been a lot of fun.
Can we thank Rhett again for...
Yeah. Big thanks for Rhett McDaniel.
You're all welcome.
Thank you, Rhett.
So that was our surprise bonus roundtable episode. I hope you enjoyed that. It was, again, a lot of fun to kind of put that together and unpack a little bit with the team what we're doing here on the podcast. It's been just a real joy to work with these folks. We've learned from each other. We've learned from our guests. And we've learned from you, our listeners. Thank you for your time and attention. I would ask that if you have a favorite Leading Lines episode or one that you found particularly useful, if you would just share it with someone. The summers, we're getting ready for season 3. Post it on Twitter, share it on Facebook, email a friend, make them listen to it in your car, whatever works. But we'd love for your help to get the word out about the podcast and what we're doing here. You can find all of our past episodes on our website, leadinglinespod.com. We're also active on Twitter, at leadinglinespod. And you can find us on iTunes and all the usual podcast places. Again, thanks for listening, and we hope you have a great summer.